Edmund Johnson on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brad Baker. This case involves the right of an officer and director of the appellee, Impact Holding, or Holding for short, to advancement under the advancement provisions of the Certificate of Incorporation of Holding. The advancement provisions include a very broad definition of those proceedings that are subject to advancement. Covered proceedings include all manner of legal proceedings and many extra legal proceedings. Indeed, the definition of a covered proceeding even goes further to include any inquiry or investigation that could lead to one of the other types of proceedings enumerated in the advancement provisions. The Court of Chancery denied the appellant's application for advancement.
Mr. Johnson,
yes.
Just a factual question. What we're dealing with here is an action to recover advancement only?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Not indemnification?
Well, to the extent that we were to be successful, we would be seeking indemnification for our fees on fees. But the proceeding below is strictly for advancement.
All right. And the advancement would be in two litigations other than this one. One would be the Section 225 litigation, and the other was the litigation involving the escrow?
Yes and no. The 225 action was dismissed based upon a venue provision and an agreement to...
That's why I was asking, you know, whether this was an advancement. You don't need advancement for a dismissed action, do you?
That's correct. And I am not pressing for that here, Your Honor.
Okay, so what are you pressing for?
It really is advancement on the breach of fiduciary duty action or the declaratory judgment action, we
the
call
declaratory
it.
Declaratory judgment
action. Declaratory judgment action, that's correct.
And not the escrow-related litigation.
No, the escrow-related litigation is different, and we're not seeking advancement for that. We are seeking advancement for the declaratory judgment action. Okay. And this is a case of first impression in Delaware. The novel issue in this case is, as we just mentioned, whether a declaratory judgment plaintiff, in this case Mr. Baker, can obtain advancement for his fees or expenses when he brought a declaratory judgment action to contest issues raised in a covered proceeding.
So the language we're having to deal with here is in defense of, is that correct?
I think that's correct. The Court of Chancery held, and we could say correctly, that there was a covered proceeding, so that's not an issue here. The holding turned entirely on whether Mr. Baker was defending or not, and that goes to the language in defending that is both in the statute and in the advancement provisions.
So if we look at this in colloquial terms, your position is the best defense is a good offense.
It actually doesn't go quite that far. Our position is that when you have a non-legal proceeding which is covered and you need to defend against it, you have very few effective options other than a declaratory judgment action, because that's how the law deals effectively with claims that are made about you in an extra legal situation. And of course, they have to rise to a particular level before you can bring a declaratory judgment action. You can't just bring a declaratory judgment action because someone insults you on the street.
Well, what level do they have to rise to?
You have to have a genuine dispute between the parties that is litigable and ripe. And I think that's a standard which has been in place for many years. It's not an unusual one. And we certainly do have that in this case. Mr. Baker was accused of breaches of fiduciary duty, and the company took various actions as a result of that. He needed to defend himself, and so he brought a declaratory judgment action. One point that may not be clear to the court, because there's some somewhat odd timing situations here. The case was originally brought when they answered, they filed counterclaims. We looked at the counterclaims that were filed did not have anything to do with breaches of fiduciary duty. There were some fraud claims in there. There were a number of other claims in there. We felt that the counterclaims would not pass a motion to dismiss. We filed a motion to dismiss most of them. We filed a claim for judgment on the pleadings on one of them, and we briefed that. In response to our motion and our brief, they filed a motion to amend their counterclaims, and they attached to that a copy of the counterclaims which they intended to use, which are the counterclaims that are at issue here. We did not oppose that. The Court of Chancery granted their motion since it was unopposed, and then nothing happened. A couple of months went by. I wrote to counsel saying, when are you going to file your amended counterclaims? Nothing happened. So we decided that we needed to move the ball forward, and we filed the declaratory judgment action. And that was in response to the investigation, which was ongoing at that time and continues ongoing today.
The declaratory judgment action was filed by Mr. Baker against Holding, correct?
That's correct.
Did Holding file a counterclaim against Mr. Baker?
No.
It simply denied. What is Holding's position?
Basically,
Baker did breach his fiduciary duty.
They denied.
Denied
most
your
of the
claim, which is they're denying a negative, which would, I guess, amount to an assertion that your client breached its fiduciary duty, right?
It would. I mean, if you look at it from a practical standpoint, you could say that they are asserting that he did breach his fiduciary duties in a denial, but they did not file a counterclaim asserting that in that.
Okay,
action.
So they're taking the legal position in response to your client's affirmative claim that your client did breach fiduciary duties, but they're not seeking any relief on account of that.
Not in that action, no. That is correct.
Or any action?
Well, that brings up an interesting question. They take the position that they have not asserted any claim, legal claim at least, against our client in the escrow action. We think that that is arguably incorrect. And the reason for that is they have asserted that he breached his fiduciary duty in that action, which is claiming that he did something wrong in his capacity as an officer and director. They are seeking a recovery from the defendants in that action. Mr. Baker is not a defendant in the action, but the defendants in that action are an LLC that he owns and a family trust, of which he's the trustee and the primary beneficiary. He is in privity with the LLC, and he's in privity with the family trust. So if Holding is successful in the claims that it's raised of breach of fiduciary duty against Mr. Baker in the escrow action, Mr. Baker would be estopped to deny any such claims in any later action, and his legal rights would be determined in that action.
Is that necessarily so?
Necessarily so.
Well, I mean, we might have an argument that, if this were to happen, then a subsequent claim against him flowing from the escrow litigation would be splitting a cause of action, or it's foreclosed by res judicata because he could have been joined in the escrow litigation but wasn't. I mean, it isn't altogether clear that the jeopardy that you're postulating would necessarily arise, is it?
The claims of breach of fiduciary duty in the escrow action, as we view them, are much broader.
Those claims are against two entities in which your client may have an interest, but those entities were selling stockholders. And all of this litigation is pursuant to an agreement, is it not?
Yes, it is.
It was a negotiated acquisition with a holdback, and the entities that sold the stock are, in litigation over whether there ought to be a holdback or not.
Yes.
Okay. But at that litigation did not specifically put your client at any jeopardy because your client is not a party to that litigation, correct?
Directly. But okay. Indirectly, I think that it does.
There is, in fact, there's no claim against your client specifically that he breached any fiduciary duty, he individually, except in the declaratory judgment action, which your client filed.
I think there is a claim that he breached
his claim. There's a claim in the form of a denial of the relief your client wants, that he breached his fiduciary duty, but that denial was required as a response to the litigation your client filed. Had there been no declaratory judgment litigation, there would be no claim against him.
I think there is a claim that he breached his fiduciary duties in the escrow action, and that that claim would foreclose him. You're saying why would it necessarily, because that action only deals with the contractual issues. They would say that they brought that claim of breach of fiduciary duty in that action only to try to get at the money, which they don't have a right to because they didn't do it in a timely way. However, if they get a determination in that action that he breached his fiduciary duty and they need that in order to get at the money, they would be able to get the money, but they could also then bring a claim for breach of fiduciary duty against him, and he would be a stop to deny it. They would have.
And I'm questioning whether it's altogether clear that he would be a stop to deny it.
I think under.
But if that were a genuine concern, why did your client, who is in privity with the selling stockholders, not seek to become a party to the escrow litigation?
Well, first, as I pointed out before, the breach of fiduciary duty litigation, the declaratory judgment action was filed before that claim was filed. Breach of fiduciary duty action was filed in October, and they didn't get around to filing the other action until December. And we were all well underway at that point with the declaratory judgment action, and that's the road which we had taken at that time.
Is your client an indispensable party to the escrow action?
It's an interesting question. Certainly his rights are impinged in that action.
Well, and are the current defendants permitted to move to dismiss because of a failure to join an indispensable party?
That is certainly a possibility. I think that certainly under Rule 19, he would be considered an indispensable party.
Well, then isn't this action premature then until the ruling is made that your client's an indispensable party?
Well, this action was brought, and the declaratory judgment action were brought before that counterclaim was filed.
I understand that. So, isn't it premature then?
Why? Because that's not the only case. That's simply evidence. The proceeding that we are defending against is the investigation in which they decided that he breached his fiduciary duty. And we are countering that with our declaratory judgment action. The other action took place subsequent to that and is evidence of what happened in the investigative proceeding. But it is actually the investigative proceeding that we are countering with the declaratory judgment action.
What's your client's role in the investigative proceeding?
Our client, you mean in the investigation by the board of directors? Yeah, he was foreclosed from that. They told him leave the room, and I say that figuratively. I think that the meetings tend to be made by telephone, so they told him get off the phone. But he was not permitted to participate in that in any way, and that's why he filed a declaratory judgment action, because he needed to defend himself, and that's how you defend yourself under Delaware law or most law. When someone is raising extrajudicial claims against you, and you need to have a judicial determination made whether those claims are appropriate or not.
Well, I guess maybe this is too basic a question. Why do you need to have such a judicial determination when there's no legal action being taken against you?
Well, there's been a number of actions taken against him. First, he was fired from his position for cause, and the cause was that he had breached his fiduciary duty, which was something which was decided in the investigation.
All right, then he can contest the validity of his firing and file a suit to determine that he was wrongfully fired.
Yeah, and then the next thing that they did is that they used that to try to take it. Well, and they also removed him as a director. And they, but before they could do that, they used the firing as a putative firing as an excuse to take his company's stock in holding, which was necessary. They had to take that stock before they could remove him as a director, and they removed him as a director as well. By attacking the root cause with a declaratory judgment action, with one action we resolve all of those issues. If we can resolve in that action that he did not breach his fiduciary duty, we don't have to worry about filing something on his employment. We don't have to worry about filing something on the stock that he has now.
Well, why aren't these simply good policy arguments for amending the statute? Because in defending part of the statute seems to be butting up against this argument, isn't it?
I don't see it that way. I think it depends on what you mean by in defending. The court below, the Court of Chancery, decided that because no claims were brought against him directly, no legal claims, that he was not defending.
Are you suggesting that if he prevails in this declaratory judgment, he's going to get reinstated and he's going to get his stock back?
Well, I think he still owns the stock. That's being litigated in Texas at the moment, and they finally recognized that they never did take his stock, that they couldn't take his stock, and he still owns it under Delaware law, but they're trying to get the Texas court to take the stock from him. So that is out there. And yes, the breach of fiduciary duty would be determinative of that Texas suit, though it might be that we could win that suit.
Well, why doesn't he just get advancement for defending himself in the Texas suit?
Excuse me?
Why isn't he entitled to advancement for defending himself in Texas?
The Texas suit, as brought, only names his companies as defendants. It does not name him as a defendant. They have the same situation there. They have carefully orchestrated this so that they don't bring a claim, a legal claim, directly against him. And
I think one of the other justices already raised the idea that he could insert himself as an additional defendant in those cases because, at least as you see it, the claims are really against him and not these companies, and that he has to be there to defend himself.
Yes, and let's just take that as a posit that he were to do that. I think you'd have the same arguments being made here, and they'd say, well, I never made him a defendant. He came in and made himself a defendant, and you'd be in the exact same situation that you're in right now.
Well, it'd be a little easier because you would be defending a claim.
Because you'd be named a defendant?
No, you'd be defending against a claim that's being brought. Your whole premise is that they're using a variety of lawsuits to attack your client but not do it directly and not name him as a defendant and instead name these companies. And I'm probably seeing it in an oversimplified way, but the minute your client inserts himself as a defendant in these claims, he's within the all fours of the advancement.
Well, I think that in the world of the legal cases, that what happens is that if you insert yourself into that case, they say, well, we never brought a claim against you, so that you're not defending from us, from any claim that we raised. That's sort of what happened in the Paolino case.
Well, wouldn't the charter language, if it were different than it reads now, really speak to your issue? The charter language, as I read it, says, is or is threatened to be made a party to a proceeding. If it wanted to, it could have said, or makes oneself a party to a proceeding in defense of threatened claims. But it doesn't say that. It says somebody has been made a party to a proceeding, and then it speaks to fees actually and reasonably incurred in defending any such proceeding. So why doesn't the language of the charter here control it?
Well, the language of the charter does control, but I don't think that that's the result from the charter, at least in light of the Delaware law in this area. The charter says is or is threatened to be made a party to a proceeding. He is a party to the investigation. The Court of Chancery has held that a person who is the object of an investigation is a party to that. In fact, party defendant.
Well, if I understood your answer to an earlier question, your client's companies are the defendants in Texas. Is that correct?
Currently, yes.
Well, and Justice Ridgely was asking about indispensable parties. If your client's companies took the position that your client was an indispensable party, then the plaintiff would have to join him as a defendant. Is that correct?
I'm not sure of Texas law, to be honest with you, Your Honor. I'd do some differently. But if you were talking about in Delaware, if we took the position that he was an indispensable party, I think that the court would, one of the options would be that the court could threaten to dismiss the case unless he was joined as a party. But
right,
I think that actually...
By the plaintiff. The plaintiff would have to initiate the process, amend the complaint, and take all the steps necessary as if your client had been sued originally under penalty of dismissal of the case on failure to do so. Right?
I think that may be the case, yes. But we brought this before that case existed.
But if he controls those two entities, it's evident, isn't it? He doesn't want to be made a party to that proceeding. Because he's not raising an issue that it's indispensable to resolve that case without him being. He's indispensable to resolving that case. In order for that case to be fairly resolved, he would have to be made a party. He doesn't want to take that position. Doesn't want his controlled entities to take that position. Isn't that obvious?
I don't know that is the case. I know that we brought this case before that case existed. And so there
put it this way. Maybe it's not obvious, but would a rational person be able to draw an inference that if one controlled two entities to litigation and there was an argument that you wanted an issue involving you to be finally resolved in that court, and you believed that under the law of that jurisdiction you would be an indispensable party to adjudicating the dispute between the current parties, that you would ask those entities you control to raise that issue before the court to either have you declared an indispensable party, put pressure on the plaintiff in that action to join you or dismiss it if they chose not to, or the court would dismiss it for failing to join an indispensable party, a reasonable person would conclude there must be some reason he doesn't want that to happen.
The reason was that we were already litigating the issue in the declaratory judgment action.
Yeah, but then he would have been made a party to a proceeding, and this language would fit like a glove. But right now it doesn't fit like a glove because he's not been made a party to any proceeding which he's defending.
Are you taking the position, as you say that he is not a party to a proceeding or that he is not defending?
I'm not taking any position. I'm just rambling because that's what I get paid to do.
Now, the reason I asked that is you said he's not a party to any proceeding that he is defending. I think he is a party to a proceeding. I think the court below decided that, and I think that's correctly decided under the Delaware law.
Your position is the proceeding to which he's a party is the fact that he's the object of an investigation.
That is correct. It was a board of directors investigation of him directly, and his brother and a few other people involved in that, too.
The drift I get from your answer to some earlier question is that your client was improperly or illegally fired because the basis for the firing was that he had breached his fiduciary duty, and he claims he did not. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it would be within your client's power to remedy that by filing an action against the company for damages or other relief based upon an improper discharge, correct?
Yes, it would.
But in that case, your client would have to pay the legal costs. It would not be advanceable.
I'm not sure of that because there is a contract, and the contract has an arbitration provision. I'm not sure whether it covers legal fees or not. I do know that there is a legal fees provision in the escrow action, so that is not particularly an issue. And I do see that I'm at 1 second.
You took the 1 second to tell us that. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Brock Shasheen, Richard Slayton and Finger, on behalf of the appellee. As the court has heard, this litigation involves petitioner's attempt to obtain advancement for two affirmatively filed actions. We heard today, I heard at least for the first time, that they're no longer seeking advancement for the 225 action. I believe in the briefs they were still pressing that argument. Apparently, they no longer are. Instead, now they're focused on the declaratory judgment action. Under the certificate provision that controls, Mr. Baker, in order to be entitled to advancement, must show two things. He must show that there is a proceeding, and then he must show that he is incurring costs in defending against that proceeding. Here, what Mr. Baker points to as the proceeding is this alleged internal investigation. In the court below, we challenged whether or not he had adequately alleged that this internal investigation is even a proceeding. The court below agreed with many of our points on that, but giving all the inferences in favor of Mr. Baker, found that an internal investigation could be a proceeding, conceivably under this broad advancement provision. But the court below, and we've determined not to challenge that on appeal, so we're not challenging that issue. But the court below found that Mr. Baker's claim failed on the second prong, because the actions that he is taking, the affirmative lawsuits that he has filed, are not defensive of an investigation.
Well, if there was a determination in his declaratory judgment that he had done none of the things that he's allegedly done as accused in the investigation or the wrongdoing that's being investigated, if the declaratory judgment action would be a judicial precedent for the fact he'd done none of those things, why isn't that a way of defending himself against the investigation?
He can certainly bring the declaratory judgment action that he's brought, and he can seek that relief. Our position is that there's simply a disconnect between the allegations concerning an internal investigation, which if you look at the allegations, he takes them from our counterclaim, and it's really a review of the financial statements. I believe the court below agreed with us on that, but still found that it was broad enough to fit within the advancement provision. You don't defend against a review of the financial statements that might lead to the conclusion that you've concealed certain financial information. Filing a new action, there's a disconnect. If Mr. Baker were seeking advancement for fees for meeting with investigators, for hiring counsel to meet with the board and explain his position, or to produce documents as part of the internal investigation, then this would be a very different case. Mr. Baker didn't do that. Instead, Mr. Baker filed a new action.
Well, as Justice Holland pointed out in his earlier question, isn't this just an example of the best defense is a good offense? He's going forward to have the underlying points in contention in the investigation resolved by a court by the mechanism of a declaratory judgment.
He may view it that way, but we believe, and the court below believe, that that's taking the idea of offense being a good defense too far, because he's filing a new proceeding. He has not responded to the investigation itself. He's going on the offensive. He's trying to preemptively make a preemptive strike, is what the court below used that language. He's not responding in the context of the forum that he's claiming is the proceeding.
Well, now I think I understand what you're saying, but how would that work in light of the language that says, is threatened to be made a party to a proceeding? Now, hypothetically, someone is not a defendant in an actual proceeding yet, but there's a threat they will be. Can they not have an advancement or be indemnified if they take steps to thwart the actual proceeding by going on the offensive in light of the threat?
Well, 2 points there. First, we have not threatened him with any legal claim. He claims, and that claim must be accepted on a brief on a motion to dismiss, that he's the subject of an investigation.
I'm just focused on whether or not you seem to be taking the position there has to be an existing proceeding to which he is a defendant, and these costs are incurred in defending himself. But the certificate or the charter says threatened to be made a party to a proceeding. So that suggests there doesn't have to be a proceeding at all yet. There just has to be a threat, and you preparing your best possible defense to meet that threat. If your best possible defense is, excuse me, Pollan and I are having a fight and Pollan is winning, I apologize. If your best possible way to meet that threat is to file a declaratory judgment action, why isn't that a way of defending yourself against a threatened proceeding which would be covered by the charter language?
Well, we don't disagree here with the court below's determination that he is the subject of a proceeding. So it's not even a threatened proceeding. The court below found that the investigation is a proceeding and that he's the subject of that. The court did not find that he had to be a defendant. You know, it was enough that he was the subject, allegedly, of this investigation. So there's an actual proceeding.
Let me interrupt because I think you're sidestepping, if I understood the Chief Justice's question. So far, the proceeding has been defined to be the investigation, right?
That's right.
And you've agreed that if he hired an attorney to put together documents or to make an argument on his behalf, that that would be the kind of thing he'd be defending a proceeding. But there could be another proceeding that's threatened, and that would be actual litigation seeking damages for breach of fiduciary duty. And if we would you agree that would be a proceeding if that were to happen, right?
If holding the company were to threaten him with a legal claim, that would fall within the advancement provision, yes.
Okay. And so couldn't he take the position that given what you've done in removing him from office and saying that he's breached his fiduciary duties, that constitutes a threat of a proceeding being brought against him, and his way of defending that threat, whether it's true or not that you're going to sue him, there's a basis to believe, there's a basis to find a threat, and the declaratory judgment is a way of defending against that threat.
That is the position that Mr. Baker seems to be taking. We believe that's wrong under Delaware law. We believe if you look at the Roven opinion by this court, the Zaman opinion by the Court of Chancery, and the Gentile and Donahue cases, all find that you don't defend against, you can't file an affirmative action claiming that just because the company said that you breached your fiduciary duties or did other things that they consider, you know, inappropriate, if you bring an affirmative action challenging that, that is not in defending. You are on offense and you've gone too far. There has to be some reasonable point.
Well, then how can you ever be defending a threat?
Well, you could defend a threat by, again, potentially hiring counsel.
To do what?
Meeting with the company, trying to convince the company not to bring the claim. But here they're not alleging that there is a threat. They have not alleged that we have threatened Mr. Baker with anything. And we haven't threatened Mr. Baker. We've been very clear that we are not threatening him with personal liability. What we have done is we removed him from office, which is an act. It's not a proceeding. Directors are not entitled to advancement simply because they get removed from the board by the principal stockholder. We fired him as CEO because we believe he breached his fiduciary duties. He concealed information from the board. Nothing about being fired as the CEO gives him the right to file a declaratory judgment action and insist on being advanced. And in the escrow action, it's important to talk about how those claims, allegations of breach of fiduciary, came about in the escrow action. After the review of the financial statements, we discovered that there were breaches by the Baker sellers of the reps and warranties, of the financial reps and warranties. So we sent a claim notice against the escrow to the Baker sellers.
Well, just to back up for a moment and to follow up on Justice Berger's line of questions, I gather your position is that during the investigation, which is the proceeding for purposes of this case, you know, there was no claim or no process asserted directly against Mr. Baker that required him to respond or required him to undergo any expense.
That's correct.
That's point number one. Your point number two is that investigation is now concluded.
We believe it is.
That's your position.
That's our position. In briefing, the other side has said
that. And after the conclusion of that investigation, that proceeding, there is no other proceeding, and that your client has not done anything since then affirmatively to draw Mr. Baker into some position of jeopardy for which he would have to undergo legal expense to defend.
That's exactly right.
The only event that's occurred at the following the conclusion of the proceeding is an event that was precipitated by Mr. Baker.
That's correct.
Is there anything further, and I'm speaking doctrinally, to you know your position? Is that the analysis that you're asking us to follow?
Yes. His affirmative claims are new proceedings in which he is on the offensive. They're not part of the investigation.
Now, you cited some cases that would suggest if the facts were the same as these and the language in the charter were the same, that would be controlling. But can you articulate a good social policy reason why advancement should not be interpreted broadly to include someone who has been publicly accused or even privately accused of a breach of fiduciary duty in their role as a director as they served the corporate entity? Why, as a matter of social policy, we should not adopt a rule that says going on the offense and seeking a declaratory judgment that I did none of the things that I am being accused of doing that are allegedly wrongful should not be covered by an advancement in expenses or ultimate indemnification?
I think the answer to that question begins with the language of Section 145E and the decision of the legislature to include in defending as a condition on the right to receiving advancement. And while Delaware certainly has a policy and recognizes the benefits of advancement, Delaware law also recognizes that contracts should be applied as written according to their plain meaning. And if the term in defending, which the legislature adopted and which many, many Delaware entities, particularly corporations, have placed in their bylaws or charters or other advancement agreements, if that language is to have any meaning, it must mean that you have to be on defense. And here, Mr. Baker is not on defense, he's on offense. So primarily, it's contrary to the language of the statute and the language of the provision here. From a policy point of view, first, Delaware corporations, if Mr. Baker is correct, would find themselves owing far greater advancement obligations than what I believe they currently are under the impression that they have. Based on the Donahue cases, the Rovin case, the Gentile case, I don't think a Delaware court has ever suggested that a party can bring an affirmative lawsuit against the company and then be advanced for it.
Is there a statutory construction principle that we should be applying in deciding what in defending means? Is this something that should be liberally construed? Is this something that should be narrowly construed? Or what?
I believe it should be given its plain meaning. And I believe its plain meaning simply is that you have to be on defense, and that if you adopt Mr. Baker's point of view, then it becomes superfluous, and the contracts or the canons of contract construction and statutory construction find that you should not adopt such an interpretation of the statute if it effectively reads the in-defending limitation out of the statute. Also, from a policy point of view, again, certainly recognize that Delaware courts have recognized the benefits of advancement to directors. But there is also a real cost to corporations and a drain on the corporation's resources when they must advance a former director's fees. Here, Mr. Breaker has brought, either himself or through entities, at least five actions against the corporation. We have not brought any actions against him. And you know, it would be a true drain on the corporation if the corporation had to not only defend the actions, but also finance the prosecution of actions from a disgruntled former director. Delaware has never held that that's the law.
You asked us to look at the statute. Is it your position that the statute's the default position and that corporations and their directors can enter into a more liberal contract under charter language that can be interpreted more liberally than the statute itself, or not?
I believe that Section 145F does give a corporation the power to adopt an advancement provision that is different than 145E. And
That is broader?
At times it can be broader, yes. The issue here, though, is that this corporation didn't do that. This corporation adopted an advancement provision that has the in defending language from 145E. And it's that language that the court below found that barred Mr. Baker's claim.
You're saying the contract tracks the statute, and the statute has an in defense of requirement?
Yes.
Well, isn't it more important that it reads in defending any such proceeding, referring to a proceeding to which a person has been made a party?
Yes. I mean, that's getting
The argument about defending could extend on the plain language of the charter to bringing an offensive action of your own to defend yourself against a threat. But here it says, in defending any such proceeding, referring to an earlier use of the word proceeding when someone's made a party to it. And that seems inconsistent with initiating the proceeding yourself.
That's right. There's really two problems here. The first one is what Your Honor just identified, which is there's a disconnect between he's not defending a proceeding brought against him. He's bringing a proceeding. This is not defending against the investigation. Apart from that, I believe under Delaware law, given the Roven case and given other opinions, that you simply cannot bring an offensive action and claim that it is defending. That if you look at the Roven decision, the court was very hesitant to find that counterclaims could be considered offense or defensive action, and ultimately considered that only compulsory counterclaims could be considered defensive, and that permissive counterclaims could not. If permissive counterclaims, when you're in the same proceeding in which you've been sued by the corporation, but you can't assert a permissive counterclaim, is not defending, then we submit that filing a separate action also cannot, under the law, be defending. But Your Honor is correct that there are two bases. One, that there's just this disconnect between the fact that he's not defending against the proceeding which he's identified, and two, that you just cannot, as a matter of Delaware law, say that an offensive action is defending. I would like to address a couple of the arguments. Well, actually, I'd like to back up and again talk about the escrow action just so it's clear. After we determined from our independent review of the financial statements that the reps and warranties were incorrect or had been breached, we submitted an escrow claim to the Baker sellers, who are the other parties to the stock purchase agreement. In response to that escrow claim, the Baker sellers filed the first action in the Delaware Court of Chancery. That's the escrow action. And the petition in that action says that the claim notice is insufficient for want of detail, that it did not provide enough detail as to what the claim was. The time period for claims had passed. Therefore, the Baker sellers said we're entitled to the entire escrow amount.
Can I just interrupt and ask you why you're talking about that, since it's not a subject of the claim for advancement?
Well, I just want to be clear, because I believe in the briefing and today, the argument by Mr. Baker is he's entitled to advancement because he's somehow defending against our statements in the escrow action. And I simply want to make clear what our statements in the escrow action have been and why he's not defending against that. You're certainly correct. He's not seeking advancement for the escrow action, but he's claiming that we asserted that he breached his fiduciary duties in the escrow action, and that somehow put him in legal jeopardy. Therefore, he's entitled to bring an affirmative action against us and have it found to be defensive. And we don't think that's correct.
I thought his position was that the claims in the escrow action are somehow a continuation of the investigation.
You know, they've said things that suggest that as well. And we again believe they've said they're not defending against that the proceeding is not the escrow action. But then at other times they've said, well, the investigation is broad enough to encompass the escrow action. We don't think that makes any sense. The escrow action is clearly a proceeding that is not the investigation as alleged. But I just want to be clear on this point that they filed the escrow action and they said that our notice lacked detail. So we counterclaimed. And in the counterclaim, we assert the breaches of the reps and warranties that underlie the claim notice. And then in responding to their argument that the claim notice lacked detail, we pointed out that Mr. Baker and his brother were the CEO and CFO of the company. All financial information coming to the board came through them. And while we disagree that the claim notice lacks detail, if it does lack detail, the reason why is because they concealed the information. And we note that we think that was a breach of his duties because he was an officer or director. But we are making that statement solely to defend against their argument that we're not entitled to the escrow. We've been very clear that we're not making that statement and seeking any relief from Mr. Baker personally. It's solely with respect to the contract claim.
In other words, even those statements would not have been made but for the fact that Baker caused his companies to bring the escrow action?
Yes.
Against your client?
Yes. We've been very clear that we are not seeking relief from him personally. We're seeking damages under the contract, and that contract has very specific terms as to who's entitled to the escrow, and it has a fee-shifting provision so that if the Baker sellers prevail in that action, they will have their fees paid. But that action is not against Mr. Baker personally. Now, there are other statements about Mr. Baker's conduct in that action because the reps and warranties that are at issue were given based on Mr. Baker's knowledge. So certainly we point out that we think that the reps and warranties have been breached. But all of that is in the context of litigation under the stock purchase agreement. Now, to briefly touch on some of the other arguments that Mr. Baker raises, he has said that he's in personal jeopardy due to the doctrines of res judicata and collateral estoppel. We do not believe that's correct. As the court pointed out, the doctrine of res judicata bars a plaintiff from bringing a suit against the same party or their privies from an earlier suit. And it doesn't only just bar the same claims, but it bars claims that, in fairness, should have been brought in the earlier suit. So if res judicata has any application here, it's a potential defense by Mr. Baker should we ever bring a subsequent claim. We've said we have no intention of bringing a subsequent claim. So his raising res judicata, we don't see how that supports his position. It seems like he's more concerned with collateral estoppel. But collateral estoppel is very different than the concept of compulsory counterclaims that the court addressed in Rovin. If a defendant fails to assert a compulsory counterclaim, you're barred in the future from doing so. Collateral estoppel, on the other hand, provides that once a court's decided an issue, a subsequent court is not going to consider the same issue. So Mr. Baker isn't concerned with barring a future claim. He's concerned that certain factual issues about his conduct are going to be determined in the escrow action, which is an action in which he concedes he's not entitled to advancement. But there's nothing wrong about that, because we've raised those issues in response to his own argument that the claim notice lacks detail. If he thinks that that's, and we're not seeking a judgment by the court in the escrow action, a declaratory judgment that he's actually breached his duties, we're just using it as a response to his argument that the notice lacks detail. If he thinks that issue is improper in the escrow action, he could move to strike it. He could move for a protective order. He could do something there, and he's not done anything.
You mean his entities?
His entities, yes. So that issue is coming up naturally as part of the escrow action, and I don't think the fact that in the context of a contract dispute with entities, the fact that some issue may later be adverse to him in some subsequent proceeding should entitle him to advancement today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.